Scott Zarin for defendants S3 Holding and Olivia Miller, who were appellants in this case. And I reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. In 2014, in August of 2014, the plaintiff in this case, who's appellee, is Seattle Pacific Industries, entered a license with defendant S3 Holding. Olivia Miller was the guarantor on that license. The license enabled the defendants to manufacture, sell, and market footwear under the plaintiff's trademarks. They did so for approximately 2 years, through 2015, 2016, and with no incident. They complied with the terms of the license. They paid the licensing fees that were required. The agreement required a minimum guarantee payment of royalties and a minimum guarantee of advertising for advertising fees in the event that a certain minimum guarantee of sales were not met. That occurred for 2015, 2016. In 2017, there had been the defendants did not make payment for their 2017 minimum guarantee payment. And the reason they didn't do that was because they had submitted designs for the footwear to the plaintiff for review, which they were required to do under the agreement. And plaintiff originally approved those designs and subsequently decided they didn't like those designs and disapproved the designs. So therefore, defendants were not able to sell. They were hardly able to sell any of the shoes because they didn't have approvals to manufacture them.
Well, let me ask you that. Okay, so this is cross motions for summary judgment, right? It's undisputed correct. That your client stopped making royalty payments, correct?
Correct.
So that's undisputed. And it's undisputed that the plaintiff has the trademark. Not what was in their head. You do have a trademark? You don't, right?
The trademarks that were licensed to defendants, to S3 Holding and Olivia Miller, were two trademarks, UB and Union Bay. Now, a trademark, you can have a trademark with respect to certain goods and not other goods.
So who's the owner of the trademark?
The owner of the trademark is SPI, except the rub here is that the trademarks were the defendants believed that SPI had ownership rights in the trademarks with respect to footwear, and later discovered or became suspicious that they did not, at the time they entered the license, have those trademarks rights with respect to footwear, but only had them with respect to other types of apparel.
All right. Well, I think those two things in my mind are undisputed, but I want you to explain why plaintiff's disapproval of your 2017 designs is a violation of the licensing agreement, and that therefore the plaintiff is stopped from seeking enforcement of your obligations under the agreement. Is not the approval or disapproval of the designs plaintiff's prerogative under the agreement?
Well, it is plaintiff's prerogative, except that that prerogative is somewhat circumscribed by the provision which deals with it. And that's provision, a standard part of the standard provisions of the agreement in provision six. And I do note here, Your Honor, that I think in my brief I had cited provision 6B, except it's really subsection A of provision 6 that requires that circumscribes in some way the discretion that the licensor has, and that provision, that 6A, states that licensee agrees to conform at all times to such standards as licensor may reasonably direct from time to time, including but not limited to standards relating to design, manufacturing, packaging, advertising, and promotion of the licensed products. So under that provision, the SPI had an obligation to approve or disapprove the designs reasonably. And if they had done that reasonably, they would have had discretion to refuse to allow those designs to go forward. In other words,
could I ask a follow-up question about that, counsel? Sure. I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, no problem.
I'm trying to figure out what was unreasonable. Is it the interval of time between the approval and disapproval, or is it what is it?
Well, it was, no, is it, well, I mean, there are other, there's a, in the agreement, you know, as you may have seen in 6B, there's a requirement that there, that the disapproval must occur within 10 working days. Now, there were many, many different designs that S3 Holdings submitted to SPI for approval. And some of those were disapproved within 10 working days. Some of them were not. So the answer to your question, in short, is both. So this came out later in discovery after the court issued a summary judgment ruling. But the other issue, as you noted, or as is indicated in the briefs, is that the design should not have been approved because they were in fact satisfactory. Now, if SPI had come to S3 Holding and said, you know, these designs are insufficient for XYZ reasons, and given S3 Holding an opportunity to remedy them in some way, that may have been sufficient, arguably. It's a question of fact, of course. But the fact is that never happened. So those two things together, and looking at the requirements of the provision 6A, required, and 6B together, you know, in tandem, required the discretion to be used based upon the reasonableness of SPI, which it didn't do in either of those ways that I just articulated.
I want to take you back to when your comment about that your clients became suspicious that plaintiffs had not been using its Union Bay and UB trademarks on footwear and therefore did not have ownership rights in these trademarks as to footwear. Can you elaborate on how not using trademarks creates a genuine dispute of material fact regarding plaintiffs' ownership of those trademarks?
Yes. If the plaintiff had ownership rights in trademarks with respect to footwear, then you know, it would not be inconsistent for them to have represented impliedly in their license that they did. But if they didn't have those rights, and they only had those rights with respect to other types of apparel, then it would have been false and fraudulent in some respect for them to have made those representations by issuing a license to S3 to produce footwear with those trademarks. In other words, by issuing a license for S3 Holding to use the trademarks on footwear, the S3 Holding it was reasonable for S3 Holding to assume that those rights were in fact owned with respect to footwear by SPI. But if it turns out that they were not, then that license could not have been issued at all. It can only have been issued with respect to apparel, which it was not, because SV Holding was not licensed to produce apparel for SPI. There were third parties that were, and I believe that SV Holding was aware of that at the time.
All right. Well, I didn't really follow that. That was not really persuasive to me about how that creates a genuine dispute regarding ownership. But I'd like you to explain why you're arguing that the district court erred in not allowing additional discovery before the motion for summary judgment ruling when you did not even file a Rule 56D motion, the vehicle for a non-movement of MSJ to request additional time for discovery.
Well, I did in my motion indicate that additional discovery was required. So although I formally didn't file a separate motion, I did in fact make that request, and I think that there's a Ninth Circuit case which I cited, in which the Ninth Circuit has indicated that there's a requirement that additional time for discovery be given under Rule 56D if there are issues of fact, and it's not an optional thing that the court can decide not to do.
But maybe I'm missing why you would need additional discovery. In any case, is it not correct that it's undisputed that you failed to make the guaranteed minimum royalty payment, the advertising payment, or for that matter, any other payment to SBI after January 1st, 2017, in violation of the contract?
Well, That's true. That is undisputed.
Is it also undisputed that you continued to sell the footwear that was the subject of the license agreement after the termination of the license agreement?
That is undisputed as well. But
is it also undisputed that you did so without providing a detailed inventory to SBI as required for authorization to sell such footwork after the termination of the license agreement?
Well, I believe that we did provide that, although I think that it was provided later than was required in the agreement.
Okay, all right. So that sounds like the kind of situation where a court can resolve summary judgment. Why do you think you needed more discovery?
Well, if I could just back up a step for a moment, there were two ways in which there was an inconsistency. The first inconsistency, as Judge Callahan discussed, was the ownership issue. On that issue, it was implied by the granting of the license that SBI had ownership rights in the goods as with respect to footwear. But it turns out that may not have been the case. During summary judgment, with the summary judgment motion, there was evidence produced which supported the suspicion, and those pieces of evidence were the registrations on the footwear, on the trademark registrations in which footwear was listed, the fact that no depositions had taken place yet at that point, and importantly, there was a piece of evidence which was an article from the Puget Sound Business Journal in which there were interviews with some principals of SPI in which they indicated that they were intending to go into new areas of business. And one of those new areas of business was footwear. That article, I think, was published in around 2003 or 2004. But the trademark registrations which were issued for footwear were issued 3 or 4 or maybe 5 years before that. So when SPI obtained the registrations, it made fraudulent allegations to the trademark office that it had ownership rights with respect to footwear, when in fact it did not. So the discovery was necessary on that point to determine whether or not there had in fact been any manufacturing and sale of footwear with these trademarks on them. That's point number one. Point number two, the other factual issue that was at issue here is that what Judge Lessing had said was that there was an inconsistency between the payment up. There was no inconsistency between the payment obligation in the agreement and the approval of footwear design obligations. Now, that was not what we had argued to the district court. What we had argued, as I mentioned before, was there was an inconsistency in the approval versus which later turned into a disapproval. So there would need to be discovery on that very question of whether there had been approvals which later turned into disapproval. And I must add that the summary judgment motion and the response and reply briefs were filed prior to the time that depositions were actually taken of three witnesses of SPI, and coming out of at least one of those depositions was evidence that could be construed, which indicated that in fact there had been a reversal of the designs, and that those reversals were not justified and therefore were not reasonable under provision 6A of the licensing agreement. So that discovery occurred, but it occurred after the court had issued its summary judgment ruling. So if the summary judgment motion had been made after that discovery was complete, I believe that the result would have turned out differently, because we could have submitted deposition testimony on the second issue regarding the approvals, and we could have and other deposition testimony on the subject of ownership, on which there was also deposition testimony from one of the witnesses, which indicated that defendants' suspicions were in fact correct, that they did not have ownership rights in the marks with respect to footwear at the time they filed the trademark applications.
Okay.
It doesn't appear that my colleagues have any additional questions. Basically, your time's expired, but I'll give you 2 minutes for rebuttal. Okay. Thank you. All right. We'll go to the appellee or respondent, whichever you want to be today.
May it please the court. My name is Mark Levy, and I represent the, we'll go with respondent, with the respondent, Seattle Pacific Industries, the owner of the Union Bay fashion brand. This is an appeal of a grant of summary judgment in favor of SPI against the licensee who, as Judge Rakoff noted, admittedly failed to make guaranteed royalty payments in 2017 and then admittedly continued to sell the branded merchandise after SPI terminated the agreement based on the breach. The district court granted summary judgment to SPI for the undisputed guaranteed royalties due under the license for 2017 in the amount of $160,000 and damages for the licensee's undisputed post-termination infringing sales of merchandise in 2018 of $31,000 and change.
So they basically say that's a double recovery and you say it's not. Correct.
Right. And that's correct. And it's
one's the royalties, the other's the infringing sales.
Correct. But it's not a double recovery, quite obviously, because the awards address two different injuries caused by two different wrongs. There's the loss guaranteed royalties in 2017 based on the breach of contract. And the important thing there to recognize is upon termination, the 2017 guaranteed royalties were accelerated as of the termination date. So 2017 was covered. And so precisely to avoid any issues about double recovery, this is very important. We did not seek trademark damages for the unauthorized sales in the second half of 2017. We restricted the trademark damages to 2018 precisely to avoid Mr. Zarin making this argument about double recovery.
And okay, yet, assuming that's correct, I guess you asked for something else, I think treble damages or something that the district court denied, but we're not reviewing that here, right?
That's correct. We did not cross appeal on that matter.
Let me ask you this. Something that I had asked appellant. Defendant appellants argue that plaintiff's refusal to answer discovery regarding its use of the trademarks made them suspicious that the plaintiffs did not own the trademarks. I think that, in the opening brief at 5, can you explain why this does not create a genuine dispute of material fact regarding plaintiff's ownership of the trademarks?
Yes. Well, because the only issue on appeal before you that this could possibly be relevant to is whether the district court properly denied the appellant's equitable estoppel affirmative defense. And, you know, one of their theories that they had presented to the district court, which was rejected, was that somehow this alleged inconsistency on the ownership issue created an equitable estoppel. So that's the context for how this could possibly potentially create a genuine issue of fact. The problem is that it doesn't even get started because the first element of an equitable estoppel defense is an admission, statement, or act that's inconsistent with a claim afterward asserted. The statement, they're saying that what they're really saying is the statement or ownership of the trademark was false, and that what it really is kind of a fraud in the inducement type of theory. But that defense was never pleaded. It's not part of the case. Any discovery on this issue of ownership could not create a genuine issue of material fact on the equitable estoppel issue because SPI's statement in the license agreement, et cetera, that it owns the Union Bay trademark is completely consistent with the claim that is asserted against the appellants in this case. So this whole issue about the trademark ownership has nothing to do with the issue before the court. It has everything to do with a fraud and the inducement type of defense that that the appellants did not make in the case.
Thank you. So you also have the order on the deadlines, and the district court basically interpreted its own orders and said it wasn't a dispositive motion. And so what's your position on that?
No, thank you, Your Honor. Happy to address that. Yeah, specifically, appellants are appealing the district court's denial of their motion to amend that was filed 4 months after the deadline for amending pleadings in the court's scheduling order. And that was not an abuse of discretion. And I think here it's useful to kind of walk down the path a bit, and I think it's pretty evident why this argument doesn't hold water. The scheduling order, which is at ER 31, says that the deadline for amending pleadings, and it sets it as October 3rd, 2018. Under Rule 15, the appellants interpret what they are trying to say is they interpret the order as that's the deadline for amending pleadings without leave of court. That's what that is. Okay. And then they say that the deadline for amending pleadings with leave is really the dispositive motion deadline. So let's test that. Okay. So under Rule 15, the deadline for amending pleadings without leave of court is set by rule. It's 21 days after service of the appellants filed their answer on March 23rd, 2018. That's the supplemental excerpts, page 92. The district court issued its scheduling order, the one that we're talking about, on May 1, 2018, after the Rule 15 period for amending without leave had already expired. Thus, at the time that the district court set the deadline for amending pleadings, any amendment would require leave of court. And it's certainly not reasonable to read that deadline as the court suddenly reopening a deadline that it already closed without any comment. That makes no sense. In addition, the deadline for amending pleadings was set 2 months before the close of discovery to allow the parties a full and fair opportunity to investigate all claims and defenses. You can, and that again is in excerpt of record 31. If the dispositive motion deadline was actually the deadline for amendment with leave, that at the time that was January 1, 2019, then the appellants could amend up to 1 month after discovery closed, which makes no sense either. So if you just work it out with the rules, this strange interpretation of the very clear order from the district court doesn't make any sense. And tellingly, the appellants cite no authority to support its interpretation of the dispositive motion deadline as the deadline for amending pleadings with leave. They're just wrong in their reply brief at page 4 when they say the Ninth Circuit, as well as a number of district courts, have found or suggested that motions for leave to amend are in fact dispositive motions subject to that deadline. The cases that are cited there don't say that at all. the cases, all the cases that they cite do is, you know, with good reason, deny motions for leave to amend that were filed on the eve of trial after the dispositive motions deadline. So their interpretation of the order makes no sense. Let's see. The I suppose the as I did want to point something out. I haven't heard any questions yet about this, but I did want to point out that we did note in their reply brief for the first time, appellants raised a brand new issue concerning how the district court applied the summary judgment standard in connection with its review of the estoppel defense. They appear to say in their reply brief the SPI had the initial burden of negating that estoppel defense in its opening brief, and the court should have denied SPI's motion on that procedural basis. Because the appellants are raising this issue for the first time in their reply brief, it should be deemed waived under Ninth Circuit authority in the Arpin case, 261 F3rd 912. But I'm prepared, having seen that, if any of your honors is concerned or want have a question about that, I'm certainly prepared to address it.
Either of my colleagues want to question Mr. Levy?
Yes, thank you. Yes.
Okay. Apparently we don't have any questions on that.
Okay. All right. Let's see. So then we really come back to the rejection of the equitable estoppel defense, that's really the core issue here. I've already addressed the issue with the first theory of that defense concerning the ownership of the trademark. The second theory, which you questioned Mr. Zarin about, was about the approval issue. And I think the most important thing to recognize in connection with this approval issue is that it does not work as a hook on the equitable estoppel defense, because SPI's claims on which the district court granted summary judgment were not based on appellant's failure to obtain footwear approvals. They were rather based, as Judge Rakoff pointed out, on appellant's undisputed non-payment of guaranteed royalties and the advertising payments, and appellant's unauthorized post-termination sales. We made that very clear in the motion for summary judgment, precisely to avoid these factual issues that appellants seek to raise on this point. The claim on which summary judgment was granted is not inconsistent with any alleged prior approval conduct or lack of conduct. I think the district court got it exactly right in the footnote where Judge Lasnik points out that that appellants did not raise impossibility defense. That's kind of what this is sounding like, that somehow they couldn't make these payments because SPI exercised its authority under the agreement to disapprove of footwear samples that it believed did not meet its standards. And Judge Lasnik points out that, there was no impossibility defense in the case, but even if there were, Judge Lasnik pointed out that there were no facts to support it, because the license agreement was very clear that it placed the approval in the sole and absolute discretion of SPI. So for all those reasons, Your Honors, we ask that the court affirm the summary judgment decision below.
All right, thank you. We'll go back to Mr. Zarin. I gave you 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Yeah, I just like to touch upon, I think, three points Mr. Levy made. The first point was with respect to the equitable estoppel defense. He had mentioned that it was more like a fraud in the inducement claim or defense, which had not been asserted. This implicates the issue of there being overlap between different types of defenses, between a fraud defense and an equitable estoppel defense. Now, as I explained in the brief and with supporting case law, equitable estoppel as a defense is in fact a form of fraud. And the type of inconsistency here that Mr. Levy had arguably mentioned, which exists, which he claims does not, is the fact that when the license was issued, when SPI issued the license to S3 Holding, it was silent as to whether or not it had ownership rights in the trademark with respect to footwear, and it implied by issuing the license that it did. And that is inconsistent with arguably the actual facts here, which it did not. And as I noted before, the depositions bore that out and can support it. And silence is in fact a basis of equitable estoppel in Washington state. Another issue which had been raised was double recovery. I note that Although it's factually correct that the request by SPI was for damages for 2018, the whole point of a liquidated damages clause in an agreement is to ensure that if there's a breach by the licensee, the licensee knows how much he or she is going to pay. So any additional royalties that might have accrued after 2017, after the termination, would have been considered by the parties when they incorporated a liquidated damages clause into the agreement in the first place. So the plaintiff SPI cannot now say that they want additional damages on top of those liquidated damages, which they claim were only.
Well, just tell me, if I did a Venn diagram, where's the intersection of the two type of damages? I don't see any intersection. They seem to be two separate things.
Well, the intersection is that any sales that would have occurred after 2017, the S3 Holding would not have owed those royalties to the licensor, SPI, because they were already incorporated into the liquidated damages provision, which required S3 Holding to pay $140,000 in royalties in addition to another $20,000 in advertising fees. So let's say the hypothetical, if in the converse...
Right, let's make it quick. You're already over quite a bit. So
if in the converse, there had been no sales that occurred, let's say after January of 2017, then S3 Holdings still would have been required to pay the entire $160,000, which would have been far in excess of the royalties that would have been generated in just that month of January of 2017. So it works both ways. The SPI can't say, because they were royalties generated in 2018, it's entitled to those. But if the royalties for 2017 were incorporated into the liquidated damages clause, because on the converse wouldn't have been the case, right?
All right, you're not hearing me. I gave you two extra minutes, and now you're two over that. So okay, thank you. Unless either of my colleagues have any questions.
No.
Just Callahan, if you could forgive me, I do have just one more. Counsel,
absolutely.
30 seconds. Earlier, you were asked to walk through the elements of the contract claim, and you were asked, is it undisputed that your client continued to sale? And you said yes, make sales. And you said yes, but. So could you just quickly, what else? Is there anything else you want us to know about that? You agreed, but you seem to want to qualify the answer. Is there anything we're missing on that one?
Well, the sales did cease at some point in mid 2018, and the reason that my client was unable to generate sufficient sales to pay the guaranteed minimum was because of the refusal of SPI to approve the designs and the reversal of the of those approvals. So you know that worked the equitable estoppel.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you both for your argument. This matter will stand submitted, and this court is now in recess until tomorrow at 9:30. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.